This is Dr. Valerie Stone of Answers About Brain Injury. Welcome back to the Brain Science and Law podcast. This is part two of our conversation with Ken Jaray about restorative mediation. In this second part of the conversation, we talked about the insurance company's reaction to restorative mediation, how restorative mediation might be used in medical malpractice cases, and even some possible applications in workers' compensation law, as well as how Ken got into this area in the first place and some very inspiring projects that he's worked on along the way. Here's part two.
You mentioned in a talk I heard you give back in January that some insurance companies are very interested in this approach. Obviously, others are very resistant. So what do you think motivates the ones who are interested in it?
Well, the feedback we got was that it's a great idea. Some said it's very altruistic. I think what happens is they saw that potentially they could reduce their cost of how they process claims. And by that meaning that if you're not fighting, you're not spending as much money on your defense lawyer. If it takes less time, generally the research is that if someone is able to deal with their emotional trauma as a result of the physical injury, that generally they can heal and come to either resolution or as close as they're going to come much quicker than someone who didn't. And so if they can move through that process quicker, there's indication that they'll spend less money on their medical costs, they're going to heal more completely, which means their other damages and losses would be less, and they'd be much more amenable to resolving their claim and moving on with their life.
As opposed to having it go to trial.
As opposed to having it drag on for 2 or 3 or 4 years. And there's a cost savings in all of that process. We spend billions of dollars in the litigation system right now. And insurance companies say, you know, if we can shorten that, if we can help people actually heal, benefits us. It saves us money. And so I think they were attracted by that. Where they were hesitant a little bit, and what we're working on now is trying to get the insurance companies and the lawyers together. Because the insurance companies say, well, the lawyers will never do this.
Okay.
That the plaintiff's lawyers will never do this. Right now we're trying to figure out how to get them together. Because there are a number of plaintiff's lawyers who say, well, the insurance companies will never do that. So this summer, I'm trying to put a panel together for the Colorado Trial Lawyers Convention that has an insurance adjuster and a plaintiff's lawyer talking about the concept and seeing if there's some common ground. I know there's common ground, but they're not talking to each other in that way.
It would be an interesting thing to watch, I'm sure.
It's a long-term process.
I wanted to talk a little bit about medical malpractice. It seems very obvious there that the physician may be going through a lot of trauma, as well as the person, obviously, who is the victim of the malpractice. So how have you seen this work, or can you tell a story of a successful case in a medical malpractice case where restorative mediation helped both parties to heal?
You know, I don't have a personal experience of that, but I've done a lot of research that indicates there are a number of organizations that are using it very successfully. Kaiser Permanente has a process that if there's a medical error, they will identify that. They will work with a physician to see whether they're willing to sit down and talk with the responsible party, and vice versa, talk with the injured party or the patient as well, and actually put them together. And they've had very, very good results with that. COPIG, which is the Colorado Physicians Insurance Cooperative, that may not be the full name, but it's the largest malpractice insurance carrier in Colorado. They have something called the 3R program. It's recognize, respond, and resolve. And what their data suggests is that those times where they do recognize early on, they attend to the situation, they respond, meaning they get the physician and the patient together or their family member together, and then resolve, offering some financial remuneration, although it's quite small in that case. But most people that go through that process don't go forward with a lawsuit. They don't have to sign their rights away to participate in this, but they're satisfied. They've had their needs met. For many people in a malpractice claim, one of the biggest needs is what happened. They want the doctor to communicate with them and tell them what happened. And if there's an error, take responsibility for it. And then stick with them to figure out how to make it right, how to repair the harms that were caused.
Where that person could then be someone they trusted as their physician again.
Absolutely. Maintaining the physician-patient relationship is huge. And most oftentimes, it doesn't happen. I can give you an example, not a successful example, but I'll give you an example that really told me how important this work is. I represented a family whose young boy, 15-month-old boy, swallowed a peanut. We think he got the peanut at a daycare center. No one knew that. But he had difficulty breathing. And he saw his pediatrician. Pediatrician said, okay, let's monitor it a little bit. Finally, it got bad enough, he went to the hospital. The hospital monitored it. He was there for 2 or 3 days, and they let him go. And 4 days later, he choked up the peanut. It got caught in his airway. He was without oxygen for over 5 minutes, and he had an anoxic brain injury. Uh-huh. And he's in a permanent vegetative state. Unfortunately, what happened was there was the relationship between the physician, the hospital, the family broke down. There was never a chance for them to communicate again. And I had the misfortune of sitting through a 3.5-week trial where the physician was there, the family was there, and instead of the normal physician-patient relationship that they had had for many, many months after the child was born, they could barely look at each other. It was horrible for both sides to go through that. It didn't have to happen. They could have been provided an opportunity to sit down for the doctor to say, I'm terribly sorry about what happened to your son. You know, I wish we had caught that. In hindsight, we could have done this, that, or the other thing. At the time, we thought we were doing the very best that we could. And the family would have been relieved to have heard that. And that just wasn't allowed to happen. And the family suffered for that, and the physician suffered for that. And so we think there's a lot of opportunity that can take place. A lot of major organizations, medical organizations, University of Michigan, I mentioned Kaiser, Copic, the Veterans Administration has a program that they've been using for many years that if there's some type of medical error situation, they address it in that way. They get the doctor and the patient together, and their claims have gone down. The cost to process their claims has gone down. I mean, there's really significant data in the malpractice area that says this is working, particularly in large organizations where they have that kind of control over the process and over the physicians. It's much harder when they're individual physicians that you have to work with one-on-one. It just takes longer to do that. But I think it has application in a lot of different areas. I think it can really make a difference.
One of the issues that I've been concerned about is elder abuse. And so I just wondered if you had any thoughts about applying a restorative mediation approach when there is, say, a claim against a nursing home about neglect or abuse within the nursing home.
I think that has a lot of potential, and it goes back to if the facility and or the provider, the aide or whoever's alleged, if they're willing to take responsibility for that. In my experience, many nursing homes kind of clam up, and they are very defensive, and it's very hard to get any communication going. And so there has to be a cultural shift, if you will, if they're willing to say, yes, you know, we didn't mean to hurt your mom or dad, or we didn't mean to do that, but it happens. We're not as attentive, perhaps, or we have a lot of things going on and so forth. And so if they're willing to take responsibility for it, I think that there's potential that we can use this kind of process. And assuming the family or the person who's in the nursing home wants that kind of acknowledgement, I think there's that potential to get them together. The real key here is are people willing to sit down, talk about it, take responsibility, repair the harms that were caused, and move on? If they are, it'll work. If they're not, it's not the right tool.
And there's always obviously going to be cases where it's not the right tool.
Right.
But there might be many more where it was the right tool and wasn't offered as an alternative.
I think that's right. And one of the things that we set out to do through the Restorative Mediation Project early on was just to create awareness, to let people know it's out there. Because if they know it's out there, at least then they'd have an opportunity to choose whether they want to use it or not use it. And that's really all we can do. It's not going to replace the traditional system. We're just going to add to the options that people have, either in a nursing home, a negligent abuse case, car accident case, malpractice claim, any situation where someone was negligent or careless and is willing to own up to that, take responsibility, it has potential.
What about workers' compensation? Have you seen any cases like that?
I haven't seen it used officially in a workers' compensation situation. I think it has the potential. There are a number of situations where a worker claims that they haven't been given the proper tools, the resources, they've been asked to do something that caused them to be injured. Again, in situations where there's carelessness or negligence, you could still apply that. In workers' compensation, though, it's typically a no-fault type of system, meaning that you don't have to prove that your employer was negligent. You don't have to prove why you got hurt. All you have to do is you prove that you were injured in the course and scope of employment. Now, I think that an employer who takes responsibility for an injury and acknowledges that with their employee probably is going to have a more satisfied employee. That employee is probably not going to have the anger and the emotional reactions that some have. And if they can deal with those emotional reactions early on to the extent they exist, I think that will help the person heal quicker, better, get back to work faster, and the cost of the workers' compensation claim potentially could go down.
Interesting.
And so it's really just understanding the principles of the person's reaction that's injured and their needs and dealing with those needs as best you can.
So how did you first get into personal injury and work injury law?
When I came out of law school, I really didn't have much of a clue, I think, what I wanted to do. But I was always interested in health. I've kind of been a health nut, if you will. I exercise a lot. I'm concerned about my health. I try to do things to help myself stay healthy. I think I guess I came out of law school as idealistic, as many lawyers are, that I wanted to help people. And so because I wanted to help people, not sure exactly how it happened, I ended up representing, or the law firm I worked with, I was given the personal injury cases. And I liked it. It gave me connection to people, which I liked. It gave me the opportunity to work with them, see them in a very difficult time, but then work with them over time to help make a difference for them, for their families, for their lives. And it was very satisfying to see that transformation. I've had a number of examples where I talk to someone early on and we talk about where they are. What does it feel like to be where you are? Well, some would describe the idea that, you know, I'm in the bottom of the hole. I just can't dig myself out of there, and it's dark and it's lonely and it's just hopeless. And over time, I would help them build a ladder out of that hole. And at first, they can maybe just see the top, but they can't get there. Maybe they can see a little bit of light. They can't quite reach the top. Well, they take a few steps up the ladder, and then they fall back down. But gradually, they start to create the rungs and take the steps that they can to climb out of the hole. And for me, that was very satisfying, to help someone through that process. And I just stuck with it for 30 years. And, people still kind of come back to me after years, and I'm delighted when they have made a new transformation about their life. They may not have healed totally in many cases because of the work I do. They don't heal totally. But they've become accepting, and they've become someone who can say, okay, I'll use the resources I have now, or the talents and so forth, the best I can, to live the best life I can.
Right. Even if it's a new and different life.
Even if it's a new and different life. I'll tell you a story. At one point, what I did is I added on to my practice. Actually, I started an organization called Challenge Rehabilitation. Again, wanting to give people an opportunity to move through some of the emotional reactions, we used experiential outdoor activities to help people regain their confidence, to deal with stressful situations, to deal with their communication. We had mostly brain injury survivors and chronic pain patients, and we put them through both low and high ropes course experiences, and it was a four-week program, and it was absolutely great to see the people that would start off and say, well, I can't do that. And then you give them a positive experience, and they say, oh, if I can do that, maybe I can do this. Or if I can do that, I can do anything. To give them the controlled environment to help them build on successes and give them successes was just really satisfying. So the Pikes Peak Challenge is another example of that. That was kind of a continuation of the challenge rehabilitation. You know, people hiking up the top of Pikes Peak, 14,000-foot mountain. And most people, particularly brain injury survivors or chronic pain patients, would say, I can't do that. Well, many of them do. And they get to the top of that mountain, and you see the smile, albeit tired smile. But it's just very satisfying. And that's what I've really enjoyed over the years, is seeing those smiles, seeing the successes, helping people, being part of that process of their success. It's just been very rewarding.
It's interesting to hear that because I think many people are intimidated by the prospect of hiring a lawyer to pursue a personal injury suit or a malpractice suit. They think it might be a lot of work for them and might be stressful. But I have found that lots of personal injury lawyers do a lot for their clients to make the process easier and to eliminate some of those sources of stress. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what your firm does, working in cases that either involve mediation or cases that go to litigation.
Probably the biggest thing we do is we really try to understand the needs of our client. Some clients will express those needs more readily than others, but we try to be there to listen. And if you're open yourself and you're willing to listen and understand what they're going through, then I know, because I've represented many, many people, I can steer them in the right direction of resources in our community to help them or deal with the kinds of emotional reactions that we've talked about. We use restorative mediation when we can in our practice. Again, it's being attuned to both the needs of the client for settlement, which many lawyers are attuned to that, but also resolution. Lawyers are just beginning to be attuned to that. We're just trying to figure that out. So we try to incorporate those concepts into our practice the very best that we can. One-on-one service, I think, is important for most people. You don't want to feel like you're a number or a file or just being shuffled through. And I think it's important for people to figure that out in advance if they can with the lawyer that they're either thinking about hiring or maybe they've already hired but they're not quite sure about that. To talk about expectations. That's one of the things that we do at the very first meeting is, what are your expectations in our relationship? And clients would say, well, I don't know. Well, of course they don't, because they've never had that experience. And so we help them. Well, here are some of the common things you might have expectations about, like how often you'd like to be contacted. What kind of information would you like to receive from us? How can we best help you with your medical needs? So we have that communication so that they understand what we do and how we do it, and of course we understand what their needs are as well. A lot of it is really down to communication and being willing to take the time to understand the needs of the clients, communicate what you're doing, how you're doing it, and to listen to what they need and try to figure out how you can best serve them. More than just shuffling papers or settling claims.
Yeah, the human approach.
The human approach.
Now, you've helped create some community foundations. You've talked about a couple of those when we were talking here. Can you say a little bit about their work and restorative mediation and how that fits in with your law firm here?
Sure. One of the things that I enjoy doing is helping either individuals or communities create a vision of what might happen and then trying to put the resources together to make that happen. I've been using the saying as I'm doing more and more of this work of becoming an entrepreneurial philanthropist. And people say, well, what is that? Well, an entrepreneurial, I start things. So I've started maybe 7 or 8-ish or so various nonprofit organizations. And philanthropy, I believe, where you put your money where your mouth is. And so I've helped to fund those organizations as well. Two of them, one would be in this context, would be the Manitou Springs Restorative Justice Council, which was started 2004, still an ongoing organization in Manitou Springs to manage the restorative justice work in our school district and our court system that I talked about earlier. Restorative Mediation Project is another example that we set up through the Pikes Peak Community Foundation, creating awareness and use of restorative mediation as we've talked about. Most recently, I'm involved in a very exciting project, slightly different of that. I've been working with our community in Manitou Springs to create a community vision and a community building process through a year-long visioning process. And it's been really wonderful. We've involved over 500 people in our community, and we're just about to produce a vision plan that really expresses the vision of our community, how we're going to move things in the future towards our vision. It's been a very exciting process. It takes a lot of time, but a very rewarding kind of experience.
Great. Finally, for anyone listening who might want to refer a case to you, either a potential client or a lawyer who might want to co-counsel or just refer a client to you, let's provide some contact information, your firm's web address and phone number.
Sure. Our web address is www.jaray, which is J-A-R-A-Y, Webster, W-E-B-S-T-E-R, law.com. We have a lot of information on our website. We encourage people to check that out. We even have a section on how to settle your claim on your own. We don't believe that everybody that has a claim needs a lawyer. We do believe everybody who has a claim probably needs help and information, but we give that out freely to people. So we have a section on our website about how to settle your claim on your own if you'd like to check it out. They can, of course, call us at 719-633-6620. We try to provide as much information as we can. We talk to people freely, freely meaning we don't charge them for an initial consultation, and freely meaning we really do believe that if you give people what they need, and they will give you what you want. But you've got to make the first effort. You've got to give them what they need. And mostly what people need after this kind of a situation is they need information. They need to know they're going to be okay. They need to know what the process is going to be, and we're glad to share that with people. And if it turns out that it's more serious, more complicated, going to need our services, we'd be glad to do that as well. We do work with a number of different lawyers around Colorado Springs particularly. But because of our work and expertise in brain injury, not every lawyer has that kind of expertise. Yeah. And so we offer that, of course, both to clients and to other lawyers as well. And we're asked on a number of occasions to work with other lawyers who have brain injury clients to help them through that process. So we're glad to deal with that. One other website that might be helpful to some people is the Restorative Mediation Project website. That's www.restorativemediationproject.org. And there's also a lot of information about the Restorative Mediation Project on there as well.
Great. Well, I'll put links to those on my website as well.
That'd be great.
Thank you very much for talking to me today. I think this is a very inspiring approach. It's a very human approach to this area of law, and I really appreciate you sharing the information about it.
Thank you, Riley. Glad you asked.
Thanks for listening to this Brain Science and the Law podcast. For more information about brain injury and about CLE courses and consulting that we offer, you can go to our website, www.aboutbraininjury.com. For more podcasts, just go to aboutbraininjury.com/podcasts.html, and you can download podcasts that we've done over the last couple of years. Thanks for listening.